that gives you no time to sit there and get nervous. My name's Henri, and I'm an alcoholic. Billy, thank you for asking me to speak, and Jeremy, thank you for driving me. My sobriety date is July 16th of 08, and I had spoke here before a few years ago, so that's not my first sobriety date, but God willing, it will be my last. So I'm here tonight to tell you what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like today. And you know, I have, my story is very confusing. You know, some people come in here and they, you know, get sober, do this thing, and just keep on doing it. And I have definitely took the hard path. But, you know, it's like, I used to wonder, why didn't I just come in and, you know, do what I was supposed to do? But everyone has their own story, and, you know, this is mine. And what I have found with my last relapse is I've definitely been able to help some people, because, you know, I was here and I picked up a 12-year chip 1 month, and the next month I picked up a white chip. So, you know, that's just my story. And, you know, there's other people, you know, I have shared my story, and there's definitely other people out there that, you know, when I get to that part, you know, I didn't just relapse overnight kind of deal. There's some stuff you do in order to get to that place. So anyway, as you can probably tell from my accent, I didn't grow up around these parts. I come from a small town in Scotland, and it was an American naval town, and that's why I'm here. That's another long story. You know, so it was definitely, if anyone knows anything about the Scottish culture, I came by this disease quite honestly. It's definitely, you know, drinking is definitely a pastime over there. Both my parents, with the grace of God, in this program, you know, my dad is 33 years, my mom 25 years, so, you know, I definitely knew about this program long before I got here, and I definitely needed it long before I got here too. My parents, you know, God bless them, they didn't, you're not ready till you're ready, and they knew that with their own experience, so they just sat by and were there for me. Anyway, as I said, both my parents are in this program, but, you know, I'm 44, so it took a while. You know, I experienced a lot of that alcoholic chaos that we all know about, whether it's, you know, your own family or the chaos you caused in your family, whatever, you know, however it was. You know, there was lots of drinking, there was lots of fighting. I have one brother, and, you know, I've heard it said here from the podium lots of times that I just never felt okay. You know, I never felt okay. It was either a lot of shame and guilt for growing up in the family I did, because we were kind of the neighborhood drunks home, and everyone knew. And, you know, I grew up, it's like the British tight lip. You didn't tell anyone what was going on in the house, but, you know, it didn't take a magician to figure out what was going on in their house with the police and music and all that good stuff. So, you know, I used to try and stay there as often as I could. I'd stay at friends' houses, always wanted to be someone else, be somewhere else, was never okay in my own skin. And just grew up really angry. I remember thinking, and I absolutely hated alcohol, because I knew even from a young age that that was what was causing all the chaos in my home. And there was a few things, you know, I didn't really know what I wanted to be when I grew up, but there was a few things I knew what I didn't want to be. I didn't want to be married, and I've done that a few times. I didn't want any kids, and I have a few of them too. And I didn't want to be like my mother. You know, I really, you know, I just hated the whole thing. And so, you know, there was no way I was going to drink. I was going to study hard. As I said, I grew up in a small town. I knew education was the way out of this town, and I was going to, ended up, it was a man was the way out of the town. But, well, it was education. I was going to go to college up in Glasgow. So pretty much during, I grew up in a church. And no one forced me to go to church. I mean, it was somewhere I really found some solace growing up. You know, it was pretty important to me. And, you know, and I even remember the day I walked away from my church, and it was because, God, I haven't thought about this for a long time, it was because I didn't pass my driving test. And I had prayed hard to pass my driving test. And I really felt that, you know, God just wasn't listening. I remember walking away, and I mean, if you see me drive, I failed it a few times after that. It was like, you know, thank God he didn't let me pass. But, you know, that was kind of, I guess, the way I had God. It was like, you know, I'll do this for you if you give me what I want. And that was kind of the way my thinking was. But anyway, going back, you know, I studied hard at school, stayed at the house as often as I could, and didn't drink. Now, I was a chameleon because I still liked to dress up and go out. So I'd hang out with the, you know, and we start over there really young, because this makes me sound old, but I was only about 16, 15. And we used to all go at the bars, and it was okay. The police used to, the taxi drivers used to say the police are having a competition tonight to see who, if they can find an over 18 in the bars. Because the, you know, the philosophy was over there, if no one complained, you didn't get carded, you didn't have IDs or anything else. So on the weekends, I'd hang out in those places, but I would not drink. And then during the week, I would study hard. And, you know, as I said, always a chameleon, always hanging out with, during the week, it'd be all the people that studied hard. And then the weekend, it was the partiers. And then one day, as I said, really, you know, I really relate to the part in the book about, you know, those grandiose ideas. I had all these, as I said, lots of anger and lots of grandiosity. And I was going to be someone, I didn't know what it was going to be, but I remember in school I would not take a typing class because I was never going to be a man's secretary. You know, I knew that. So I didn't have to learn to type. I do that for a living now. But, you know, that was the kind of thinking. It was just that anger. And, wasn't my type. What else? So, anyway, got through high school, angry, probably a bit, when I can't remember the exact age. My first drink was in France, and that was from my aunt and my cousin, and had a glass of wine. I remember getting all giggly and all, you know, that kind of stuff. But that was it. I mean, that was when I was 13 and never thought about booze again. And then I was about 17, I was out, and I remember standing in the nightclub, and everybody else was having a lot of fun. And I took a glass of shandy, which was lager and lemonade, and I don't know what the thinking was behind it. It just was, I guess, trying to fit in, trying to feel better, I don't even know. But what I remember is the feeling that it gave me that time. I remember the thought was, I understood for the first time why my mom drank. Because I felt, I was like, whoa, this is some good stuff. And that night I got drunk and blacked out, and that's how I drank from there on in. I was never a social drinker. I drank for the effect. I loved the effect booze gave me. And not, you know, and there was no consequences for a long time. It was like, I think about how everything I'd done in my life for the next few years was to drink. I mean, it didn't matter what was going on. I wouldn't be there unless there was booze involved. We were going out at 9 o'clock, I'd start drinking at 8, because my thinking would be, you know, it would save me money. There was plenty of nights, actually, I wouldn't even get out. I'd start drinking, I'd pass out, and all my friends would go out. I'd come in, waking up, and they were coming back in again. I'm like, what happened? And I'd be so mad that they didn't wake me up and take me with them. So I went to college up in Glasgow. I got in. And by that time, you know, my drinking wasn't every day. When I got to college, it was pretty much every day. Because they had a student union, which was where they gave you booze, and they subsidized it, so it was cheap booze. So this was like, whoa, right on the premises. And So I was there, and it was either statistics or student union. And, you know, and student union always won it. So for the first year, every single day I'd go home and I would be drunk. I drank every day. I started doing stuff. That's when I started. Before that, it was all pretty much fun, but then the guilt started coming in because I don't know about other women in here, but for me, with booze came men. It was kind of hand in hand, and, you know, and I realized I did not have a... Because as soon as I stopped drinking, I don't do that stuff today. I didn't have to try and not do it. It's just something, it doesn't happen to me when there's no booze in my system. So anyway, I started doing stuff at college that I was ashamed of. So I'd have to skip for a day or two because I had to let the shame die down. You know, and then, you know, it talks about that strange mental twist because this would happen maybe on a Monday night, and by Wednesday night it was like, you know, it wasn't that bad. You know, it really, you know, next time I'll do different. And that's how, you know, next time I'd go and same things would happen, and it just started getting worse and worse and worse. At the end of that first year of college, I had met a sailor, a British one, and he drank just like me. And, you know, we'd split up at least twice a month. And it was just lots of chaos. But by the end of that first year at school, I was flunking. And, of course, I told you all I had this grandiose ego. And I didn't want to tell people I was failing. And, you know, I was, instead of just thinking, all right, let me try and get it together and reset statistics, it was like, how do I get out of college not letting people know what's really going on, like family and all that good stuff back in my little hometown? So I came up with, I don't know who came up with it because we were drunk, but the idea was to get married. So this time, you know, this was me, it was never getting married 2 years previous. I'm marrying this guy I don't really particularly like, but, you know, he was moving to the other side of the country, which, if you know Scotland, is about 2 hours away. I mean, it wasn't that dramatic. So we decided we were going to get married, get a neighbour house, and I don't know, then I could tell people that I was leaving college to get married. That seemed like a really good idea to me. I remember going home and telling my parents, and by this time both of them had got sober. And they're looking at me like, are you insane? And they took me to the priest. Well, I later come to find out the priest is dead now, but he ended up becoming a member of this program before he died. So his thinking obviously wasn't that straight either. So I remember he sat there and he goes, are you sure? Because this is for life. And I'm like, yeah, we're sure. And you're supposed to evidently have like 6 months of religious training. Well, he skipped by all that for us, and we went on the fast path. And we got married, and I remember my wedding night. No, excuse me, I don't remember my wedding night at all. But, you know, I had this big wedding. I remember right before it, I was telling everyone, I don't want to get married. I knew it was insane. And my dad, God bless him, said, this pig for now. So that was the end of it. So, you know, I walked down the aisle. No one would let me drink before the wedding because I was going to take communion. And so as soon as the wedding was over, I remember going to the reception. Every table had a glass of wine. And by the end of the night, I don't remember a thing, but I knew all the bridesmaids and that were going to party. And I wasn't allowed to go, and I was ticked off. And my new mother-in-law dragged me up the stairs to the hotel room. And, you know, the next day I woke up and, you know, thank God it was my new husband, but it could have been anyone because I don't remember a thing. And, you know, and it just got worse from there on in. So we went to, you know, I remember thinking this time I was just turned 20 and I'm like, what the hell happened? You know, these last 2 years it was like, you know, it went like this and, you know, I wasn't employable. I had no skills. Because I don't even think I did learn to type at that point. So, I mean, I had zero skills. And, you know, I went to this military naval place, and if anyone's ever lived in those places, I don't know about them over here, but back home it was like just party city. The men would go on the boats and the women would get in party. And I'm sure the men were partying wherever they were too. You know, and I got there and I was really empty inside, and I'm like, you know, what do I do now? And I'd seen people pushing strollers. So I'm like, that seemed like the next right thing to do was, you know, have this baby. So I did, God bless her, and partied. I mean, that was it, just lived to party. And me and him would split up at least once, twice a year. My dad would drive over from the west to the east coast with a big removal van, move me back, and then, you know, we'd get drunk one night, hook up again, I'd be back there, and then this went on. This chaos went on for a few years. And, you know, I look back, and I look at my daughter's pictures, her, you know, the first birthday party, and it was her sitting on the table, surrounded with wine bottles, and me and all my girlfriends. I mean, you know, there wasn't another kid in sight, and that was, you know, that was, because none of my friends, of course, you know, none of them had a kid at this time. So anyway, that's what it looked like. We split up a few years later. Of course, I moved back in with my mom and dad, and, you know, I think of them, and it's like, they had stood by me, because, I mean, they knew I had this disease long before I knew I had this disease. And, you know, and I even think I knew I was an alcoholic, but it was okay, because I didn't know any other way. I could not imagine at this point in my life without alcohol, because where would you go? What would you do? I mean, to me, it was like bars, because I was a, you know, as soon as I had a couple of drinks, I'd be on the phone trying to find a babysitter, trying to find people to go out with, because as soon as I had a drink, I thought I could dance, and, you know, I had to go find somewhere I could dance or something. So anyway, you know, I was getting really sick, but this time I was like 23, 24, pretty depressed, because life seemed kind of over. You know, I'd been married, divorced, had a baby, no job skills, and moved back in with my mother. So, you know, things weren't looking that great. And then I met an American sailor. And he was not one of us. I mean, I've since found out he's got, you know, his own stuff. But, you know, he had this plan that he wanted to have the house with the white picket fence and the kids and, you know, the dog and the cat and all that good stuff. And, you know, I had run out of ideas. I had no clue who I was, what I wanted. I just knew I didn't want this life anymore. So, again, that's twice. The third time I got engaged, I do remember. I'm married to this man here. I do remember, but the first two times, I don't remember. We woke up, he was over here, I was over there, we were on the telephone, and evidently, and that's why I know blackout and passout are very different, because when you're in a blackout, you can have some wonderful conversations and do some wonderful stuff, evidently. Because, you know, I woke up the next day, he called me and said that was the best conversation, and he's glad he, you know, I feel the same way, and we were engaged, and I'm like, well, that was awesome. So, I guess I'd been to my friend's wedding that night, that's what it was, and I must have come home and thought, I want to get married again, that seems great. So, anyway, I come over here, met his parents, and it's so funny because we've been dating maybe 8-9 months over there, and when I came, I should have got a clue. Of course, he met me in the EM club, the enlisted men's club, or maybe it's not enlisted men, enlisted club for the Navy. Hadn't really seen me sober that much, although I kind of kept it together somewhat. I'd only saved my really big drunks till he was gone on the ship, and with him I tried to keep it together because, you know, I remember, I guess maybe a year after we got married, if it was that long, he said, you should have got an Oscar because, I mean, you are not the person, you know, and I can keep it up long enough to get what I want. So we come over here to meet his parents, and they lived in Richmond, and I remember on the way down, he's like, can you tell them we met? I think it was like the library. I'm like, and do you need to tell them? I mean, it was all these things he didn't want me to tell his parents, and I should have got a clue. And I got there, and, you know, they weren't, you know, this was this guy who, you know, had his whole life, and he was marrying someone with a kid, being divorced, no job prospects, I mean. And then the very first night I got there, I'd been drinking wine coolers all the way down 95. And I stood in a bee in the grass. And we didn't have anything like Benadryl over where I came from. So my foot was swollen, and he got me Benadryl. Well, evidently Benadryl and wine coolers don't mix, because I fell asleep at the dining table on the very first night I was meeting all his family. I passed out. So that was the impression I made. So anyway, we get married, moves over here, and it got really, very empty, very depressed really quick, because I knew no one. I couldn't speak your language, because no one understood the damn word that came out of my mouth. You know, I didn't drive. I mean, can you imagine living in Richmond and not being able to drive? I couldn't drive. I had got pregnant again, so now I've got a brand new baby, this 4-year-old. I'm here all by myself, and he was at full-time college, and I got really, really depressed. And before, drinking had always been fun somewhat. I mean, it always, you know, it was always partying, girlfriends, fun. And when I came here, I had no one. His family didn't particularly like me, and, you know, God bless them. They had reason. I'd go up there for dinner, and they would have to ask him to take me home, because I get obnoxious with drink. And so anyway, I got really started taking some, and this is, you know, singleness of purpose, but, you know, I started taking some pills as well, because, you know, I wasn't getting out to party as much, and it was hard to, you know, be smelling, reeking of booze all day, all by yourself. So, you know, I thought I had found the magic cure, because nobody would know about that. So I started spiraling down really quick. And what I'd done for the next few years, basically, is I would save up all year so I could go back to Scotland for all summer and party. I mean, I'd drop the kids at the airport. No, I'd take them home. I wouldn't drop them at the airport. I'd get out at the airport, I'd go home to my parents, and I'd drop them off. And I remember my mum and dad used to beg me, stay in tonight, don't go out tonight, you'll be jet-lagged. But not as soon as, you know, the airplane touched down, I dressed up and out partying. And, you know, I'd disappear, I'd come in the next, you know, I was a puker. Puker, bedwetter, I blame it on my kid, bring my kid into the bed with me, blame it on her. I'd eat bread. It's funny, this is the thing I used to do, I was like a squirrel. I used to hide the bread from myself, because when I came in and I'm in a blackout, I'd find the bread, I'd eat it, and I'd always fall asleep, and I'd wake up in the morning with a big pouch of bread. And I don't know, I mean, seriously, I don't know, I must have come in and be like a squirrel and hunt for the bread and start eating and then fall asleep. So anyway, you know, why I didn't die in my sleep, puking, choke or whatever, I guess God had a reason to keep me here. And so mom and dad, I mean, they hated me coming to visit. I mean, they would tolerate me for the grandkids. So that's pretty much the way it went. You know, I'd just stay over here, miserable, hating life, but telling everybody back home I had this wonderful American life, send them pictures. Because, I mean, one of the things that really amazed me is you all have carpet the same color. Back home, we have every room's got a different color carpet. And I remember the apartments and that looked so expensive, all the same color carpet. Send pictures home, look, I've arrived. The swim pool at the apartment complex and all this. And just living this lie, just telling everyone I was happy over here. And I remember right at the end, which was 1996, the first time, my mom, my dad, and my brother, I don't know if he's one of us, because he's done this since he's 16, he seems to have a, his life seems to be pretty manageable compared to the way it was for me. But, you know, he came over here and I remember him crying. I mean, I just looked like hell. I'd got physically, I had this ulcer that I ended up being in the hospital with. My liver, you know, the liver, and our, you know, the last couple of weeks I went to the hospital in, out at Fort Lee. And the doctor, they took my liver stuff and all that, and he came out and he go, "You like to drink? You Scottish?" And I'm like, "No." You know, I mean, my health was just shot. And inside, every time I'd drive along the street, there was this tree, and I just wanted to swing the wheel. I did learn to drive while I was here. And, you know, I was just dying inside, and I just had no clue. You know, it talks about that, couldn't imagine life with or without. And I really couldn't. I mean, and I thought at that time that pills were my problem. The doctor, you know, the doctor's like, "You need rehab." And I'm like, "But I can't tell my husband." Like, he didn't know. You know, I thought I was keeping this really well secret. And anyway, so I had this idea that the pills were my problem, not the booze. Because, as I said, everything I'd done revolved around drinking. If you went bowling, you drank. I didn't go to the movies because you didn't drink. I mean, you know, that was always my thinking. If it didn't have drinking, then I won't go on. And one of the things I remember really scared me right before I came here was I was out one night with my husband and his boss. And we went out early, and we were playing pool. And by this time, I was drinking White Russians because the milk, of course, is coating this ulcer I have. And, you know, they were done. They went out at 6 o'clock. They played pool to 9, and they were ready to go home. And we went to the British pub. And, of course, I don't remember, but I wouldn't go home. So they left me. And the next thing I remember, and when I passed out or blacked out, I never came to until the next day. I mean, it's just the way it was for me. And this time I came out the British pub, and the air hit me, and I was struck sober. I mean, I just totally stood there, and I was totally sober, and I was with this big crowd of guys. And I'm like, you know, I woke up, and I'm like, "Where are we going?" And evidently I gave them this story, you know, "My husband doesn't love me, blah, blah, blah." And they were taking me to a hotel. So, you know, I got back in. I was like, "Hell no, get in." I called my husband. He came pick me up. But that really, really, you know, that really scared me, because back home, it's a small town. Everyone knew who I was. So if I was passed out on a bar stool or, you know, in the corner, I always get in a taxi, and they always took me home. So I never had to be fearful of that stuff. And here I'm like, this is a whole different game over here. So I pretty much started drinking in the, you know, the last little while, drinking just at home. Anyway, the idea came to me that I definitely needed to quit the pills, but, you know, I wasn't going to quit drinking. So I'd heard about, I knew what AA was. AA was where you all didn't drink, but you done drugs or whatever else you done here. And NA was where you didn't do drugs, but you drank. So that was my thinking. So, you know, I went to an NA meeting, and they read some literature, and it says alcohol is a drug, you know, so they don't drink. I'm like, "Do what?" So I felt like I'd been duped, you know, but, you know, thank God. And I came out, and I remember just walking around everyone and saying, "You don't drink wine with dinner?" I mean, I just couldn't wrap my head around that, like I ever ate and drank at the same time. And I remember asking the question at this time, my daughter, my oldest daughter was 10, and I'm like, "So what about my daughter's wedding? I can't drink champagne." I mean, I wanted all the answers, you know. And they, God bless them, they just told me to just keep coming back. And I did go back there for a while. But, you know, I'm not a drug addict, so I didn't get the solution there. You know, I couldn't relate to the, you know, if you don't relate to the problem, you're not going to get the solution. So thank God I found my way into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was a real God thing. Long story, but, you know, I came here, and I remember the first time I went to my first AA meeting, and I truly, I mean, just the relief, because, you know, at that point, I wasn't drinking, but I wasn't working a 12-step program, so I was really miserable. So anyway, I found my way in here, and I was so gung-ho. I was, you know, just so excited. Threw myself into this thing. Started going pretty much every day. And my marriage had fell apart by this time. He really didn't get the fact. I mean, it was kind of like he just thought I was using the recovery program versus the alcohol and all that. Is, you know, it just didn't work, and you know, and I lost custody of my kids back then. It's pretty much when I got sober, my whole life fell apart, which is fine today because I see why that happened. It was like, you know, it was all built on lies and sticks, and you know, I had no foundation as a mother, as a wife, as anything. So for that first pretty much year, all I had, or even longer, all I had to do was focus on me, because I didn't have anything else. And I remember I'd come in and I'd be crying because I wasn't seeing my kids, and the women were just awesome. They just said, keep coming back, because if you keep coming back, keep doing this thing, you will get those kids back. And you know, I'm here to tell you, I was at my oldest daughter's wedding last year, and my middle kid graduates, well, she turned 18 last week, she graduates and goes to college, and you know, I've had those kids for a long time back in my life, so that was the truth. I remember the very first time I got them back, my youngest one, and I guess I had just over a year, I can't remember, a year and a half, whatever it was, and I met a woman at a meeting that night who was standing crying. I went over, and she just, that very day, I had just got her back that day, and that very day she just lost custody of her kid. And I was there to tell her, just keep coming back, you will get that kid back. So, you know, there's no mistakes in God's world. Everything I have went through in this program, everything I've went through, the drinking, everything, I've been able to share it with someone else. So there's, you know, there's definitely no waste in God's world. Anyway, so started really getting my life together, started doing the deal. My life started to change. I got a sponsor. I remember getting a Saturday night home group, and that's why home groups are so important. You know, the only time I didn't have a home group since I came in here in 96 was this 8 months, 9 months period, something like that, and that's when my relapse came right after that, because I didn't have a home group. And you know, I didn't do that intentionally. It was like that one didn't suit me, and I was going to get another one. I was going to get it, going to get it, going to get it, and didn't happen. Anyway, so let me think, where am I? I told you it's all very confusing. Really doing the deal, getting better, got a job, and you know, I can't go into details, but everything happened. It was like little miracles all over the place, like the job, the apartment, when I left, it was like God, you know, what I had discovered is if I'm doing the right thing, if I'm doing God's will, it's really easy. If I'm doing my will, it's hard, because I've got to push it, manipulate it. But if it's God's will for me, I have found over the years, I know immediately, because it just falls into place. Whether it's something I want or don't want, and quite often it's something I don't want, but it's really easy, I'm like, all right. So anyway, you know, I'm doing the deal. I get a really awesome, you know, career. Start getting respect. And I'm thinking that husband of mine at the time, or my ex, after about 5-6 years in this program, the man that wouldn't let me see my kid was scared that for my kids, my kids to be around me. I was thinking of switching careers, and he says to me, he goes, you know, you'd make an awesome school counselor. I'm like, whoa, you know, that's someone that wouldn't, you know, that's that working this program. That's someone who didn't want me to be around his kid, thought I'd be good with someone else's kids. But anyway, so, you know, life went on. I'm doing meetings. I'm working the steps. I'm sponsoring lots of women. I'm being actively sponsored. And I'm not going to tell you it was always good, but, you know, slowly but surely, life got definitely, you know, more than I ever thought I would have when I came here. It's like I just came here to stop hurting. And I remember people saying to me, if you wrote down your wildest dreams, you'd be shortchanging yourself. And that was definitely the truth, because I couldn't even have envisioned the life I was given here when I get sober. I mean, I couldn't even have put it into words or into thoughts in my head. So life got so good, I got really busy with outside stuff. I met this man in here, and, you know, for the first time, it was like God chose my husband, not me, or not the booze. So, I don't want to go too fast here. But anyway, you know, so I met him. It's all his fault. And, what was it? So, life got really good, you know, and I got pregnant. I had, as I said, I've got this 23-year-old, 18-year-old, and a 2-year-old. So, but anyway, life got really good, and that was even previous to the pregnancy or anything. You know, I got the house, the car, the career, the man, all that stuff. And I got really busy, and I lost my gratitude. It was like, you know, the gifts that this program had given me had taken me away from the program, you know, and I really forgot where it all centered. The reason I had my kids is because I put recovery first. That's why I got my kids back. The reason I had a career is because I put recovery first. And then I started putting these things in front of recovery. And slowly but surely my thinking started to change. And he'd come in from the meeting, I'd go, so how are they bitches tonight, you know? I mean, I got, you know, where I didn't like y'all. I just started getting really resentful and angry. And I don't know. And then, as I said, I did get pregnant. And it's, you know, it's funny because, you know, when you look at a relapse, it's like it happens long before, you know, that mental, the praying started, you know, the praying stopped, the help another woman, you know, I had a bunch of sponsees, and slowly, obviously, one by one, they started going away. I wonder why. And, you know, and it was a relief to me, because it was one less problem, one less thing to have to deal with, you know, and that should have been a red light, but it wasn't. It wasn't like, and, you know, I never even stopped not coming here. I always came. I'd done enough for you to sit so that you would think I was doing okay. And I really, you know, I did not, I mean, I'll tell you a little bit about that. You know, I just started taking some pills I shouldn't have been taking. And for me, you know, I don't care about anyone else, but I have to know my truth. And my truth is that stuff will take me back to drinking. And I'm not sober because I'm relying on that. This is just for me. I'm relying on that versus relying on my higher power, my sponsor, my meetings, helping other women. That stuff became unimportant to me. And anyway, at the very end, you know, I'm coming in these meetings. I'm sitting there. I'm angry. I don't fit in here now because I'm living this lie, and I know I am. And that's a really tough spot to be in because I'm not okay out there and I'm not okay in here. And so right at the end, I mean, I was just like, I really wanted help, but my ego, my pride was like, how the hell do I tell these people, you know, what I've been doing or what I'm doing? And so at the very end, you know, I went to the gas station. I was just dying inside, and I was going to go pick up some booze, and because I figured if I got drunk, Jeremy would definitely have picked up on that, for sure, for sure. You know, I'm thinking, you know, if I just get drunk, then I don't have to ask for help. Y'all are going to just help me. That was what my thinking. And I went up there, and I'm looking in the cooler, and I knew my higher power was right there, because I knew if I took that one drink, I might never get back here, because I know what alcohol does for me, and there would be no guarantee. You know, I caused chaos. I just knew if I let that, you know, I'd heard other people talk about it, if I let that that bear out the cage, I might never get back here again. So I stood there and I thought about it, and I couldn't. So I went, I got a pack of cigarettes. I didn't smoke, but I had to leave there with something. So, you know, I got cigarettes, I went home, and I went to bed, and Jeremy thought I had the flu, and, you know, I'm telling him, I'm just, I had the flu. And I woke up that next morning, and I was getting ready to go to work, and I'm standing there, and I'm just dying inside, and I'm looking in the mirror, and I heard this voice, as clear as I'm hearing my own right now, and it's, you're going to die. And so I bargained with God. I said, I'll call my sponsor. If she answers the phone, I'll tell her. If she doesn't, I'm going to work. Of course, she answered the phone, and I had no idea what I said to her. But what I do know is, you know, I called him, told him what had been going on, and freedom from that. It was more, because, you know, when you come here the first time, it's like, you know, I had been given this gift. I knew what recovery had given me, and when I was losing it, and it was just, you know, the worst feeling in the world, and the freedom from, I had, you know, because booze for me blacks everything out, blocks it out. That didn't happen to me this time, so I knew what I was doing. There was no relief. I wasn't getting any relief. So anyway, you know, I came in here, I picked up that white chip, and it was the most peculiar night, because it was the very same meeting I'd picked up my 12-year chip. And of course, nothing really dramatic had happened in the month in between. And, you know, I stood up, picked up that white chip, and no one clapped, and then slowly but surely you just heard that, you know, and then it got louder, because everybody's like, oh my God. And, you know, it was really hard, but my fear was, would my ego let me come back? If I picked up that white chip, what would happen to me? And I'm here to tell you the most wonderful stuff's happened for me since I picked up that white chip, and I am so grateful I got to do that. Because I had no, you know, I was told the first time, you can't save your face and your ass at the same time, and, you know, that's my experiences. You know, I came in, and you know, that next morning, I picked up the white chip that night, and I got up the next morning, and I was like, what happens now? I mean, I didn't know it was easy enough doing that, but I'm like, what do I do now? And what I had to do was be new again. So that meant going back to those, doing my damnedest, and by this time I did have this baby. Doing the 90 and 90, call my sponsor, doing all the things we were taught in the beginning, picking up that phone, asking for help, letting people know where I'm at. And the first few months, I'm not going to say it was easy, because it wasn't. I didn't know where I belonged. You know, it was, I had sponsees before, you know, and all this, and I had to come back and be new again. And every meeting changed their format for me. Every meeting's like, anyone with less than 90 days, stick up their hand. Anyone with less than a year. And I'm like, when did all these formats change? I'd never paid attention before. And I'm like, all right, God, my ego's crushed. It's enough. It's enough. But, you know, I'd done it. And the last couple of years, well, year and a half, I guess, coming up on 2 years, have been some of the best in my sobriety, because I don't take this stuff for granted anymore like I did. You know, the first time coming in, I don't mean it wasn't hard, it was very hard, but, you know, I started getting all this thing and I forgot where it came from. And this time, you know, there's not a day goes by that I am not grateful for my, you know, my family, my career, you know, the people. My phone is full of women. I have so many women friends today. When I came here, I didn't like women. I had no use for them. You know, I would have went to all the men's meetings if I could, you know, they'd let me in. And today, you know, it's just not like that for me. And as I said, I'm sponsoring women again. I am sponsored. I come from a strong sponsorship family. My home group's Jaywalkers, I forgot to tell y'all, meets on a Tuesday and a Friday night. And, you know, I have a strong home group. I'm active in that home group. I get my position just up, but I had a wonderful position of getting the speakers for the last year. So that really helped me get back up here again. Because see, to come up to the podium and even read, I'd be shaken after I came back. And whew. Sorry. But it's just the biggest gift, and, you know, I have this 2-year-old today, and I get to see him, and I was going to screw all that up, because he was just a baby. You know, he was just a baby when this happened. And, you know, it had been a rough pregnancy, and he was sick when he was born. And, you know, I have to tell you, our wedding was put on by AA. It was all people in AA through our wedding. Her baby was really sick for the first 4 weeks, and it was people in these rooms that called, brought us food. I mean, this is the only family I've known in this country. And they have always been there, and, you know, it's like, I can't imagine my life without it. And, yeah, this disease is so cunning, because it creeps up. Because I had no intention of leaving. I mean, I didn't know anything else, but slowly but surely those resentments, you know, they're not praying, they're believing that I was keeping myself sober. I mean, somewhere in my head I really believed that I chose not to, you know, I chose not to drink. Stop praying in the morning. Today it's like, I keep it real simple. I realize that my prayers today are actions. I don't have to sit for prayers in the morning like I used to do with my meditation books, my journal, and blah, blah, blah. Today it's like, you know, I get up, I keep it simple, and I get out there and try and be the best person I can be today. You know, I try and, actually, where I work right now, I have quite a few people that are in active addiction. And they come to me, they know I'm in the program, and, you know, I don't put, you know, it's attraction, not promotion. So they know I'm here, and they know I'm here if they need help. And so I get to carry this message anywhere I go. And I know my behaviors and the way I act today is attractive, because I ask God to lead me. And for the most part, I'm just changed. It's like my pet name used to be Psycho Bitch. And, you know, I mean, truly, that was, my dad said I could cause a fight in an empty room. I was just one angry person. And today, you know, I know I'm changed. It's like I don't have that. By working these steps and doing this process, I have been changed. I know what that is like today. And the first time around, I don't know. You know, it was like I was so ungrateful for so many things, thinking I should be somewhere else, or I don't even know. But this time around has just been such a gift. So, you know, I certainly don't suggest relapse. But what I'm going to tell you, it's like, you know, I see a lot of people that have time, and if they go back out, they don't get back in again, because it is their ego, and, you know, the pride, and, you know, and you just hear about them, or you end up going to their funeral, because I've been to some of them, you know, people with time that either went back out or blew their brains out, maybe didn't go back out, but blew their brains out, because they couldn't go honest and just ask for help. So if anyone is sitting here and, you know, it's like, you need help, you just ask. It's like, you know, the newcomer is the most important person, but so is people that's got time up in here that we need help too. Anyway, today my life is awesome. You know, waking up in the morning, number one, I know who I'm next to. I know where I am. And these are all gifts. These are all gifts, you know. It's like I know what I said and done the night before. I mean, that's just the basic gifts that you forget once you've been here for a little while. You know, as I said, in my job, I just got a promotion where I'm in charge of people. I mean, me, you know, it's like, because I get along with people. Not everyone in my work knows, of course, I have no reason to tell them that I belong to Alcoholics Anonymous. They don't need to know unless they need to know. And but they know that they can come to me and tell me whatever, and it never gets passed along. Or, you know, it's just to be respected and to be asked back and to, you know, to sponsor women and just to waking up in the morning and not have that feeling in your gut waiting on the other shoe to drop, because that's how I felt for a long time, and for a long time in this program too. Those that big long period of time just walking about here with a big knot in my gut, and today it's like it's just, I'm just free. I've built a relationship with higher power. It's not the same one as I came in here with. You know, as I said, I grew up in a religion, and it was kind of like once I started screwing up, I really thought I was going to hell. You know, it was like, so I'm going to hell in the handbasket. I used to have that attitude. I may as well have a good time on this, on the earth, because next, you know, the next place won't go be so good. And today, you know, I had that loving, forgiving God that's there for me no matter what. No matter what I'm going through, and I don't always see it at the time, but in hindsight, he's been there the whole time. And sometimes it's real clear, I can hear him real clear, but most of the times I have to come around here because he talks through you all. And if I don't come, I mean, that's the one thing, if I don't come here, I ain't going here, because I've tried the churches and all that, and he talks through you all. So anyway, I think it's cake time, right, Billy? So anyway, again, thank you, Billy, for inviting me up here tonight, and thanks for letting me share.